Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Happy Friday, everyone. I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehr. We're going to start today with Supreme Court news. The nine justices are meeting today to decide whether to take up any of the many gay marriage cases that have been making their way through the courts. The challenge to California's Proposition 8 has garnered the most attention, but it might not be the case that justices decide to weigh in on. Emily Bazelon is here to lay out the possible scenarios for us. She's senior editor at Slate and a panelist on Slate's Political Gabfest. Welcome back to WNYC, Emily.
Thanks so much, Anna.
So the primary question today is whether the justices will decide to weigh in on Proposition 8 or whether they're going to focus their attention on the Defense of Marriage Act challenges. Is that about right? And what are the different legal questions that these two scenarios would bring up?
That's exactly right. And we're kind of talking about a form of gradualism, an incremental step toward gay marriage. Or in the Prop 8 case, we have kind of the big kahuna, a case that could conceivably order up same-sex marriage for the entire country if the court were to find that it was unconstitutional to deny same-sex couples that right.
So Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has said publicly that she expects the court to weigh in on gay marriage this year. Do we know for sure that the court is going to take up something today?
We never know for sure what they're going to do, but they have so many cases in front of them right now. There are really 10 different petitions, and that puts pressure on them to make a decision. And the reason there's so many cases is that gay couples all over the country who live in states where gay marriage is illegal are saying, wait a second, why don't I get my federal benefits as if I was married just like everyone else? And so that's the basic clash going on.
So the Defense of Marriage Act from 1996 basically says that states do not have to recognize other states' recognition of marriage, right? But this also brings in the question of federal benefits for gay married couples in states where marriage is recognized. So are those two questions going to be answered by some of these DOMA cases?
So there are two parts of DOMA, just like you said. The first part is about states not having to recognize other states. The second part defines marriage as the union of a man and a woman for purposes of giving out federal benefits. And it's the second part of DOMA that these cases address, not the first part.
Not the first part. So what would happen if the second part, if that's overturned? Say you're a gay married couple in New York State. All of a sudden, the second part of the law is overturned. You're eligible for Social Security benefits. You can file joint federal tax returns. And then you move to a state like North Carolina. What would happen then in terms of the federal recognition of your marriage if you move states?
Well, so that's like the next question, right? So if these cases that are currently before the court were to be decided that these gay couples in New York and Connecticut and other states that recognize gay marriage, if they get their federal benefits, then we'll have that case on the books and that will play out in those states. And it won't address what happens if you move to North Carolina. But then you can imagine somebody then bringing that case next. And that's why this strategy for recognition of gay marriage is more incremental and step-by-step.
So let's look at Proposition 8, because throughout all of the coverage of this case, it's been this is ultimately going to go to the Supreme Court. This will ultimately go to the Supreme Court. So a little bit of background. A state Supreme Court in California ruled that limiting marriage to a man and a woman was unconstitutional, but then California voters weighed in 2008. 52% defined marriage as an institution between men and women. So then gay marriage was no longer legal in California. This case was argued by David Boies and Ted Olson, a bipartisan legal sort of super team that famously were against each other in Bush v. Gore. Isn't this the one that kind of is the bright lights that the Supreme Court, if they really wanted to say, we're going to clarify what is marriage in the United States, isn't this the case to take up?
This is the giant step case. It's the grow for broke case. And it's interesting, you're right, that Ted Olson and David Boies brought this case rather than some of the gay rights lawyers who've been working on this issue for years and who feel like the incremental strategy is the safer one. So what's happening in this California case, it directly raises whether denying gay couples anywhere in the country the right to get married is simply a violation of equal protection law. And you're right, that would clarify the definition of marriage, but it's also a big roll of the dice, because for the court to order the entire country to recognize gay marriage when we're in a moment where we only have 10 states that do so, that's a big shift. It would be the court really stepping in on a social issue that's very much still in play. And the question is, you know, whether that's a good role for the court to play, whether that's a good strategy, whether it could backfire, all of those tactical questions.
And by backfiring, you mean, I mean, what would happen if the court decided to hear the appeal of Proposition 8 and then found that there was no equal protection clause, that clause does not apply to gay couples? What would that mean? What would that mean?
Well, that wouldn't be so great for the cause of gay marriage, because then you would have on the books a Supreme Court precedent that would squarely deny this right. And we've seen this happen before, right? In 1986, in the case Bowers versus Hardwick, the court had before it a challenge to sodomy laws across the country, which were blatantly prejudicial against homosexuals. And the court said, you know what, the states can keep these sodomy laws. And that stayed on the books for many years, and it took them, you know, another 17 years to overturn that precedent. That's not necessarily progress.
And you also wrote about Loving versus Virginia. That's the decision that struck down restrictions on interracial marriage. How did the Supreme Court kind of time the way they came in on that question?
You know, the challenges to the state bans on interracial marriages, they start coming into the federal courts in the late 40s and 50s. But if you think about people's attitudes in the country at that time, there was a lot of opposition to interracial marriage. We look back and it seems prehistoric, but that was how people felt. And the Supreme Court stayed out of that issue essentially for 20 years. It wasn't until 1967, when the polls had started to move, that the court took its stand. And even when the court acted, most of the country did still have these anti-miscegenation bans on the books. So it was still a fairly important step for the court to take.
Oh, interesting. So they waited a little, but they still made a pretty important decision and struck down state laws.
Exactly. And you know, it's always an issue when you have these big social matters before the court. It's principle versus timing, right? I mean, we look back and it seems unconscionable that the country ever banned interracial marriage. And yet, in a particular moment in time, people feel differently. And the question is it the role of 9 Supreme Court justices to try and move that needle ahead of where people actually are?
I want to go back to DOMA because, again, just a reminder, President Obama has said that he is not going to defend DOMA in court. So it's a lawyer for the House of Representatives that's doing it. What's the precedent for that?
Once in a while, the federal government will decide they don't want to defend a federal law anymore because they think it's just too problematic. It's very unusual. It's, you know, you don't usually want the Department of Justice saying, sorry, Congress, we think this law can't be supported. But in this case, that was the stance the Obama administration took. They're still enforcing the law, but they're saying we're not going to argue in court for its constitutionality in these incremental challenge cases. And so instead, this bipartisan group of legislators, of congressmen, are defending the law. And that means that people who believe in this law and feel like they have a real stake in it being upheld are arguing for it.
And one of the DOMA cases that could be taken up involves a New Yorker, 83-year-old Edith Windsor, who sued after she faced more than $360,000 in federal estate taxes when her partner died, which she would not have if their marriage was legally recognized. In any sense of which DOMA challenge the court might take up, and does it matter?
It doesn't so much matter. There are lots of very sympathetic stories out there of couples who got married and then one of the spouses was denied benefits. You're right, Edie Windsor had to pay this big estate tax. There are other people who have been denied medical benefits. What matters is that the court pick a case that's clean, where there's no question about, you know, whether the plaintiffs have standing, whether they're the right people for some procedural reason, just a kind of case straight up that raises this issue. And then there's one other procedural wrinkle, which is that Elena Kagan, who's on the Supreme Court now, was Solicitor General when some of these cases were coming up. And so the court also needs to pick a case that she was not involved in so that they have all 9 justices sitting.
So you mentioned Justice Elena Kagan. So in terms of the current makeup of the Roberts Court, what do we know about how they've handled civil rights cases and cases that involve these sort of different community and social values in different parts of the country?
the Roberts Court and the Rehnquist Court before it created some pretty progressive precedents, and we have Justice Anthony Kennedy to thank for some of those decisions. So, for example, there's Lawrence versus Texas, which was the law, the ruling that finally got rid of the sodomy laws. And there's another important case called Romer versus Evans, which was about a statute in Colorado that essentially didn't allow for instead of having protections for gay rights and employment, it disallowed those protections. And Justice Kennedy said that's not okay because the only real motivation he could see for it was what he called animus, essentially prejudice against gay people. And so those are some pretty good steps toward a ruling in favor of gay marriage.
So Justice Kennedy, do you think that we will be looking at him again as a potential swing vote, or because he's had that key role in those other cases, will he have a slightly different role?
I think he is the swing vote. I mean, it seems like there would be four clear votes for recognizing same-sex marriage in this context and four against, and that this will be all about Justice Kennedy. And when you read the briefs and petitions the various gay rights groups have been filing in these cases, they are very much pitched at Justice Kennedy.
So just to get back to the court could hear whether in states where gay marriage is legal, like New York, like Connecticut, that whether it's constitutional for the federal government to not recognize what the state recognizes, but not necessarily whether other states need to recognize marriage in the same way. Was that incremental approach at all involved in striking down some of the interracial marriage restrictions? Did the federal government recognize marriages in some states that other states wouldn't recognize?
No, it was different. We didn't have a federal law that kind of stepped in. We just had these state-by-state bans. So this is a different kind of moment. And, you know, one question to ask yourself, I think, in deciding what you think about these cases and what the best next step is, do you believe in making all the states do something because there's this really important civil rights principle at stake, and maybe it doesn't matter so much whether everyone's ready for it in those other states or not? Or do you think, well, actually the most effective way for social change to happen is to allow people in a more local and regional way to kind of make their way to it? And it's very clear with gay marriage that the polls favor gay marriage. I mean, when you look at young people's feelings on this issue, they are very much in favor of gay marriage in a way that older people aren't. And so there's this sense that this is going to happen. The question is just when.
What about that? The rapid movement in terms of public opinion polls, and then also some of the victories we saw in November with Maine and Maryland referendum votes on gay marriage, which of course followed just a few months after North Carolina approved an amendment banning gay marriage. But how does the court sort of take that into account, that public opinion seems to be rapidly shifting on this question?
That's such a good question. The court isn't supposed to be, you know, reading the polls and directly responding. On the other hand, it should be aware of the sort of climate of the country. And so things that can seem like they couldn't possibly be constitutional can seem like, well, actually, maybe they are. And you really see this with this issue, because 12 or so years ago, when the sodomy case, Lawrence versus Texas, was decided, Sandra Day O'Connor wrote a concurrence in which she said, oh, no, we're not taking a step toward gay marriage. Of course, gay marriage could be unconstitutional. But then we had this big trial in the Prop 8 case in California, and there was no good reason for gay marriage to be unconstitutional. It was amazing how thin and pathetic the evidence against gay marriage was. There are religious reasons to oppose it, but those are not constitutional reasons. And as a result of that shift and airing all of those questions, I think the country is moving and the court should take that into account.
So you mentioned that some advocates for gay marriage have had some concerns about timing and whether this comprehensive question that Prop 8 arises in terms of a fundamental right to marriage for gay couples. Do you see that sort of reticence in the way that briefs have been filed with the DOMA cases versus the Prop 8 case? Or are they aligning in a way that the advocacy community seems to be pushing the court to do the incremental approach as opposed to the more comprehensive?
That the gay rights community does want this incremental approach. And the lower court opinion in the Prop 8 case in California, which was written by Judge Reinhart, is very careful to limit the way that decision applies to California. So he said, look, you know, yes, there's a constitutional right to gay marriage in California, but that's only because the voters granted this right and 16,000 couples got married and then it was taken away. So it's not a decision that forces the other states in the jurisdiction of Judge Reinhardt's court, the Ninth Circuit, to recognize gay marriage. If that had happened, we would have gay marriage in places like Idaho and Arizona where it does not poll well. Instead, there was this very careful effort to limit the decisions the way it applies, and that could allow the Supreme Court to just ignore it for now.
So prediction time, what do you think is going to happen today?
I think they'll take at least one of the DOMA cases, and I bet they'll leave the Prop 8 case alone, but we'll have to see. I don't know.
And how soon will we know what they decide?
They could tell us this afternoon. They could tell us Monday. They could tell us in 3 months. You know, they could postpone as well. I imagine there will be some announcement this afternoon or Monday morning, but it's up to them.
All right. Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate and a panelist on Slate's Political Gabfest. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we have Admiral Thad Allen, who commanded the federal response to Katrina and the BP oil spill. Now he's leading a commission analyzing New York's emergency response. So if you experienced emergency response, interacted with emergency responders after Sandy, call in with your stories. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Admiral Thad Allen after the break.